Her access to the TAC link allowed her to see that 3 Yellow Team aircraft had been declared shot down with all hands lost near the river where Irene and Derek had hidden their fighter. The TAC link also reported the Yellow Commander had committed an aircraft and 2 squads of troops to sanitize the flight corridor along the river. But until they could be certain the green threat there had been neutralized, the area was a no-fly zone, and that seriously screwed up the entire Yellow Team assault plan. Emily smiled inside her suit, even as she wished she had fallen in a more comfortable position, because a stump was digging into her back. Ruhar skin suits were great in many ways, their flexibility usually making them superior in comfort and agility to rigid Krestang-powered armor. But at the moment, the flexible nature of a skin suit was causing a throbbing pain in Emily's back. A Krestang suit would have rigidly propped itself against the stump without her feeling it at all, but her Ruhar gear was bent over the stump as if the skin suit did not exist. That was a design flaw in Emily's opinion. Or, she thought with exasperation, maybe there was a setting she didn't know about that could relieve the pressure on her back. The suits did have injectable nanomedicine for pain relief. The units issued to her team had their medical gear modified for human biochemistry, but she was reluctant to use it. Activating a suit's internal medical systems would be reported up to the medical people at Green Team headquarters, and that would prompt questions. She did not want hamsters asking why she needed pain relief when she was merely laying down in a forest. UNEF could not afford for the Ruhar to think humans were any softer than their physical limitations made unavoidable. She grunted as she shifted around inside the suit as best she could. After she had been declared dead, her suit had lost power, its nanomotors inactive. Not only did she not have the advantage of powered movement, the suit was holding her mostly immobile, except for her being able to wiggle a bit inside the material, but it was like trying to adjust her position inside a wetsuit. The damned thing would not move as she wanted, and it did move just enough that she couldn't quite relieve the pressure on her sore back muscles. Skin suits would not allow the wearer to die or be injured. If she had died during the war game by falling into water, the suit would prevent her from drowning, even swim her onto land by itself. Its impressive caretaker feature did not, however, consider the comfort of the occupant. The upper left corner of her visor showed there were more than 16 hours remaining in the war game schedule, and nearly 2 hours until a crew would come to her position to bring the dead and injured out of the exercise area. 2 more hours of a tree stump digging into her. An alarm sounded in her helmet, and her suit immediately returned to full function. The first thing Emily did was roll off the stump, then kneel down to stretch her aching back. She spent several minutes just stretching, bending her sore back and catching her breath, wincing from sharp pain. "Is everyone all right?" she called on the team channel, before wincing at her own reliance on alien technology and flipping up her visor again to breathe unfiltered air. She could see Coulter, Jarrett, and Chaika running easily through the woods toward her, and she envied their youth, for they didn't appear to have stiff muscles from lying on the ground for hours.
"I'm fine, ma'am,"
Dave changed his reply, red-faced and almost referring to their CO by her first name.
"Why is the exercise over early?"
That level of information was not available to him.
"I hope there wasn't an accident."
"Good point, Chaika."
"Strebich,"
Perkins called to her chief pilot.
"You two okay out there?"
"Oh, just fine here, Colonel."
Irene's voice was mirthful.
"We're kind of in a swamp near the river here, but we'll get out okay."
Perkins caught the amusement in the pilot's tone.
"What's so funny, Strebich?"
"As a hamster recon team searching for us," Irene laughed. "And they just about had us cornered in this swamp when the exercise ended early. It's a group of cadets, and I gotta think their commander is pissed. We led them on a chase all over these woods for the past couple hours. Now his mission will get scored as a failure."
"Got it. Well, screw him, right?"
Perkins knew that remark would eventually get picked up by Yellow Team Intel and they'd be unhappy. She also knew her own Green Team would be listening. Perkins hoped they would be amused and impressed by the aggressiveness and fighting spirit of humans.
"Colonel Perkins?"
Nert snapped a U.S. Army-style salute toward the human commander.
"Nerdy," Shauna admonished their young alien liaison. "Remember, we don't salute in the field."
"Oh, sorry."
Nert's expression was crestfallen.
You humans call that a sniper check?
You got it. Any sniper in the area will target the senior officers first.
Colonel?
Nert was aware that lieutenant colonels were commonly referred to as colonel, except in formal settings.
I do congratulate you and your team on a daring and successful mission in this exercise, but the fact that your success caused humiliation for that yellow team cadet leader may create a problem for you, for all of us, in the future. He would be a bad person to have as an enemy.
Why? Dave's eyes narrowed. Who is that jerk?
His name is Bift Kolsun,
Nert replied with a slightly puzzled expression.
Biff? His name is Biff?
Dave laughed, and the teen joined him.
Yes, Bift. Why is that funny?
Nert cocked his head, wondering if the gang were playing another prank on him.
I am told that name is similar to a name not uncommon on Earth.
Biff is an uncommon name. Unless your enemy is Marty McFly.
Dave thought his own joke was uproariously funny, and he got the others laughing.
Who is Marty McFly?
Nert asked, lost.
Is he a famous hero from Earth history?
Yeah, he's famous, all right. He invented the flux capacitor, Shauna explained. No, that was Doc, what's his name? The guy with the wild hair,
Jesse corrected his girlfriend, which drew an eye roll from her.
Doc Brown, Perkins declared, sometimes annoyed at how conversations among her young team veered off target.
Nert, why would it be dangerous for us to have this Biffed guy as our enemy? He is a senior-level cadet, but he's only a cadet. He doesn't outrank you, and he sure as hell doesn't outrank me.
His mother is a general in our army, and his father is a high-level official in the federal government. He could make much trouble for any of us. My aunt very strictly will not use her position to help me, but Biff's parents have many times unfairly secured advantages for him because of their power and influence.
Politics.
Jesse spat on the ground in disgust. The expression on Perkins's face echoed Jesse's disgust, but she couldn't allow her personal feelings to affect their mission. Almost every human interaction, and now every interaction humans had with other sentient species, involved politics on some level. She looked at the UNEF symbol that was now displayed on the left upper arm of her team's skin suits. The composition of UNEF was entirely politics. Only 5 nations were included in the expeditionary force, though several other countries had wanted to contribute soldiers. Being excluded had been a blow to national pride, and Perkins was sure there were still hard feelings about that back on Earth. Brazil had argued strongly in the UN Security Council that their army should participate in the X-Force, but that country's lack of nuclear weapons meant that Cristang did not take the Brazilians seriously. Emily wondered if the army of Brazil knew how lucky they were to have dodged that bullet. She also noted that the influence of Nert's aunt, Baterna Logelia, was the reason the boy was a member of Perkins's team.
Okay, people. We have enough enemies in this galaxy. Let's not go making more. We treat this Biffed cadet with respect, got it?
Yes, ma'am,
Shauna agreed stiffly.
But if that punk-ass kid disrespects one of us...
She looked at Nert, and the team understood how protective she felt about the goofy young alien.
I am not taking any crap.
Jarrett, if this Biffed character needs slapping down, I will handle it myself.
Perkins also treated their young alien team member with motherly concern. The alien senior cadet had taken particular pleasure in the simulated killing of Nert, and Perkins wanted more info about that.
Nert, do you and this Biff have a history? Anything we should know about?
No, we do not have a history.
Nert shook his head in the exaggerated fashion he had learned to use when communicating with humans.
We barely know each other at school.
I think...
The young Ruhar looked at the sky while he thought of the correct phrase.
I think he is just a dick.
Hearing that word come from Nert's mouth and his totally serious expression made the team double over with laughter.
Nert, Shauna said, wiping tears from her eyes. Where did you hear that expression?
Did I not say that correctly?
Nert's eyebrows scrunched together with concern.
I was... taught that expression by soldiers in your American 3rd Infantry Division. At first my translation told me it was a slang for...
He looked away from Shauna with great embarrassment.
Male genitalia? Then it was explained to me that calling someone a dick means they are sort of a huge douchebag?
Perkins laughed so hard she almost choked, and Dave patted her back.
Oh, she looked at the alien cadet when she was able to talk again. Nert, you truly brighten my day.
Is what I say funny because I am not saying it correctly?
The cadet looked to Shauna for guidance, his lower lip quivering slightly.
No, Shauna assured him. You are using the expression correctly, and you are 100% right that this biffed character is a huge douchebag.
She bit the inside of her cheek to stop herself from laughing.
What makes it extra funny is that we do not expect to hear you using human slang.
Oh!
Nert perked right up at hearing Shauna's explanation.
Yes, the humor comes from the incongruity of...
He stopped because he was smart enough to know jokes can't be explained. Trying again, he simply stated,
The humor comes from the fact that all species can agree Biffed is a dick.
Nert, Perkins shook her head, grinning broadly.
Maybe you should tell Dave and Jesse what other expressions you learned from those jokers in the 3rd Infantry, hmm?
Yes, ma'am,
Nert grinned back.
They taught me many interesting and useful sayings. For example, several of the male soldiers kept saying they wanted something very badly, and my translator told me they were using a term for a feline pet animal from Earth. That puzzled me. Then I learned what they wanted was some sweet puss.
No, okay, Dave patted Nert on the back, hard. Let's you, me, and Jesse talk about that, huh? Senior Cadet Biffed Colsoon was indeed pissed, monumentally pissed. Not only had a group of lowly humans suckered him into leaving his assigned patrol area along the river, but when he broke the war game rules to run back to the river and chase the two human pilots, they had slipped away and evaded him for hours until he had them cornered in a swampy area and was about to send two of his team to circle behind and trap them. Just then, the alarm had sounded to end the war game, cheating him out of even a minor victory. He had broken the rules and would be punished. And now he had nothing to show for it. At least if he had captured the human pilots, he might have been able to justify his actions as preventing the humans from getting away with cheating, since cheating is the only possible way two slow and clumsy human pilots could have shot down 3 Ruhar aircraft.
Come out!
He shouted, brandishing his rifle toward where he knew the pair of primitive creatures were huddled behind a large tree.
Okay, Irene stood up, brushing muck off her flight suit's legs from when she and Derek had been crouching behind a tree. She waved her arms to show her pistol was still in the holster strapped to her hip.
The war game is over anyway. You got lucky, and you cheated!
Biffed shook a fist at her and pointedly did not lower his rifle, even though the weapon could only fire low-powered targeting laser beams.
I will be reporting your shameful underhanded tactics to the war game authorities!
Cheated? Derek retorted hotly. We cheated? You cheated. You're supposed to be dead, you punk-ass bitch. That's why we were able to track your position, but you couldn't locate us. The control system cut off your suit's chameleon and stealth features.
Derek looked at Irene as he spoke, as he had just then figured out why the two of them had been able to evade the team of 4 Ruhar for hours. While their flight suits were not fully capable combat skin suits, they did provide enhanced speed and power, plus features for concealment. During the chase, Derek had wondered why their flight suit's sensors had been able to detect and pinpoint movement in the forest, while it appeared the 4 Ruhar had only a vague idea where the humans were. Now it was obvious, as lights on the chests of the 4 Ruhar were blinking red, indicating the war game computer had declared them all dead. The 4, who Derek now could see for certain were cadets, should not have been able to move after dying in the game.
Dead soldiers are not supposed to be chasing us. We will be reporting your actions to the referees.
Derek did send a message to the wargame computer for the attention of the referee committee that enforced the rules and investigated possible violations by both sides. All he did was transmit a file containing sensor data after they left the Dobra,
showing he and Irene had been tracked and pursued by 4 Yellow Team soldiers, and including a short video of their encounter with the cadets after the war game ended. Derek's intention was to show the referees that if the humans had done anything that slightly bent the spirit, if not the stated rules of the mock combat, the 4 Yellow cadets had flagrantly violated the rules by continuing to participate in the action after they had been declared dead. He figured the rules committee would have to go easy on the humans when they saw how badly their own people had cheated. He was correct, and he had no way of knowing Lieutenant Colonel Perkins would have preferred to keep the whole incident quiet, and she was still mildly pissed at him for acting without checking with her first. "I'm sorry, ma'am," he replied as the assembled 6 humans waited for a green team transport to pluck them from an open area next to the river. A yellow ship had already picked up the 4 cadets, and another yellow transport had landed across the river next to the bog where the abandoned Dobra sat partly submerged in a bog. Through his Z-phone, Derek had been watching a Ruhar dressed in the blue and yellow uniform of an aircraft mechanic slogging through the bog to the Dobra, then crawling on top and around it. He could not hear the communications from the mechanic to the airbase, but from the man's gestures, Derek guessed the mechanic was anything but pleased. "I wouldn't have done anything," he stated truthfully, for he assumed the war game computer had noticed the 4 dead cadets breaking the rules by running around. "But that cadet said he was going to report us for cheating, so I thought the best defense is a good offense." Emily Perkins knew sports metaphors were as popular in the military as war metaphors were in sports, and she found both to be silly. War was not a game, and even the most intense football game was not combat. Quarterbacks could be hit hard by 300-pound linemen, but no one was shooting at the quarterback, nor did the quarterback need to worry about being targeted by laser-guided missiles from over the horizon. In spite of her feelings on the subject, she avoided rolling her eyes at the pilot. "In the future, check with me first. I am responsible for the actions of this team, so any reporting should be done by me directly." "We did nothing wrong," Irene protested while touching Derek's hand reassuringly. "None of us did anything wrong. The operation was flawless," Perkins agreed. "That doesn't mean there won't be any blowback on us. We really crashed a real aircraft." She used the word "we" because she had approved the crazy operation, and Emily Perkins did not hang her people out to dry when they went off script in good faith. Strebitch and Bonsu had followed the spirit of the war game by acting the way they would in real combat. The fact that the war game computer did not declare them dead after the hard landing proved the desperate tactic of splashing their fighter across the river surface had worked. "Nert," she nodded toward the team's official liaison officer, "tells me that cadet leader you encountered is politically connected. He could make a stink about us destroying a combat aircraft, even get your flight certifications revoked or suspended." "What?" Irene screeched in rage. Perkins held up a finger to forestall an argument. "That is why I didn't want us reporting that cadet for violating the war game rules. The computer must know what he did, and the hamsters will deal with it or not." She shrugged. "Now we have forced their hand by bringing the incident to the referee committee, because they will have to address it, and the cadet will blame us, fairly or not." She paused to listen, and the entire group turned toward the south where an aircraft was beginning to transition from level flight to hover mode, its turbine engines pivoting to support the craft's landing next to the river. "Everyone," she raised her voice to be heard over the approaching roar of the aircraft, "let me do the talking when we get back to base."
"They cheated!"
Biff jabbed a finger awkwardly close to Perkins' face when they reached the Yellow Team headquarters.
"Hiding a frontline Dobra fighter gunship in a river is not an approved..."
"Approved?" General Days cut off Biff's argument with a withering stare.
"Cadet, do you think in real combat the Kristang will conform to an approved set of tactics? I can assure you they will not. Neither will the Wargalin or any other force we may encounter. If you are unfortunate enough to face the Kristang in battle, you can expect they will hit you with every dirty trick they can imagine, and they will not care whether you have a preset set of tactics to counter them. If your rigid thinking is an example of what our military academies are teaching now..." Dates shook his head sadly. then our people had better become accustomed to losing battles and territory. Lieutenant Colonel Perkins, he turned to the human leader, speaking slowly to pronounce her rank correctly as a sign of respect. Your team has once again proven to be resourceful. Clever. He paused to see if that word translated correctly, and continued when Perkins nodded happily. And courageous. If the operation had not worked as planned, the repercussions to human involvement with our military could have been long-lasting and detrimental to your people here on Getanu and beyond. While I am not pleased to be on the losing side of your unexpected success, his grin reflected the chagrin he felt, I am glad this was only a war game exercise, so we can learn much without getting anyone killed.
They destroyed a frontline combat aircraft,
Biff insisted, proving he did not know when to cut his losses and keep his mouth shut.
They did damage an aircraft, yes, General Days agreed. Cadet, you will find aircraft are frequently damaged in combat.
That was not real combat,
Biff nearly shouted. When he heard others gasp that he had interrupted a general officer, he bowed his head.
I apologize, General, sir.
Days snorted and looked down his furry snout at the cadet.
A war game is only useful if the people involved act the way they would in actual combat. Colonel Perkins, I understand your military organization has a motto to the effect of train the way you fight.
We believe that very strongly, General Days, Perkins replied with deadly seriousness. Days nodded approvingly.
We use technology to make wargame exercises as realistic as possible. But if the people involved, he glared directly at Biff, do not act as if the combat is real, they learn nothing. Tell me, Perkins, why did you plan to sacrifice your ground team and possibly your only aircraft?
Perkins had an answer ready because she only needed to tell the truth. Because my team had multiple significant disadvantages in both physical ability and experience with your equipment and tactics. The only possibility for us to contribute to mission success was to use unconventional tactics. Otherwise, we could have stayed back at base like some people wanted us to do.
Quite so, Days said with admiration. Cadet Colsoon, I suggest you throw away whatever texts the Academy has assigned you to read, and instead study the actions of Colonel Perkins, both today and from the events of them activating Mazer projectors and destroying a Krestang battle group, a real battle group, he added for emphasis. As to the Dobra fighter that was damaged,
he downplayed the damage to the aircraft, which had been declared a total loss and was being salvaged for parts.
The aircraft logs stated was not actually combat capable and should never have been assigned to participate in the exercise. It was not, as you described, a front-line combat aircraft. It was a source of spare parts, and now it is fulfilling its true mission.
General Days actually winked to Perkins.
That our counterparts on the Green Team stuck the human pilot with that barely capable piece of...
The translator stumbled, and Perkins heard it say junk in her ear, but she thought Days had used a stronger term.
"'Is shameful, and does not reflect well on us as a people.'
"'Colonel Perkins,' Days bowed slightly, "'please convey my apologies to your pilots. Your team succeeded despite having the deck stacked against you.' Perkins bowed curtly to acknowledge the compliment, and her eyes twinkled. Have you ever gone into actual combat without having the deck stacked against you, General Days?
No, the Ruhar commander chuckled. I have not. Cadet Durndorf, he addressed Nert. You intend to continue serving as liaison officer with Colonel Perkins?
Nert brightened up immediately.
Oh, yes, sir, General Days, sir,
he replied with pride, throwing his shoulder back and standing tall.
You are a fortunate young man, and if you keep your mind open and learn, I expect great things from you.
Oh,
Nert swallowed hard as he realized the pressure on him.
Sir, I hope to serve with distinction, sir.
He nervously ignored Jesse's instruction not to make a sir sandwich when speaking to an officer.
Cadets, you are dismissed.
Daze sent Nert and Biffed away with a curt nod and turned his full attention to Perkins, gesturing her to follow him as he walked toward his command center.
I have a call with the Admiral in only a few minutes, but please walk with me and indulge me in a question, Colonel. How did you get the idea to hide a fighter aircraft in a river? Sensors aboard my aircraft that were declared shot down did briefly detect a submerged anomaly, but the crews ignored it. That will be a lesson learned to go straight into the standard operations manual.
It was Captain Derek Bonsu's idea. Perkins felt a jolt of pride that lowly humans had taught another lesson to the Ruhar. He was assigned to an airbase before and during the Kristang occupation. She smiled, and did not mention that Bonsu had been taken off flight duty back then and limited to being basically a gopher for the aircraft maintenance teams. He observed a Dobra fighter being subjected to something you call a water immersion test. He was surprised to see that after being in a water tank for several hours, the fighter was able to pass flight tests and return to service with minimal maintenance.
Yes. The general's face lit up with understanding. I remember that. The company that builds the Dobra was testing one fighter from the batch delivered to Gatanu as part of a service contract. That aircraft has what I think you call a ditch switch to close external ports in case of a water landing. But the purpose of that test is also to demonstrate the aircraft will not be damaged by flying through heavy rain or by fire suppression equipment in a hangar.
Heavy rain? Perkins' eyebrows flew up. That must be some seriously heavy rain.
Our aircraft must be capable of operating in extreme environments, Daze explained, because we never know what planet we will be called on to occupy next.
Ah. Perkins made a mental note to remember that lesson. She could no longer afford to think only in terms of conditions on one planet, whether that was Earth, or Paradise, or Camp Alpha. She needed to consider what her team would do under conditions she could barely imagine.
Chapter 6 Perkins tugged at the knees of her formal uniform pants to straighten the crease before she took a deep breath and held up a hand to knock on the doorframe of the UNEF liaison office. On Earth, a general officer would have a waiting room with at least one staffer to filter visitors. But on Paradise, such luxuries had been dispensed with. Even at UNEF HQ in southern Lemuria, the tents and hastily constructed prefab buildings used as offices had no waiting areas. In most cases, they didn't even have doors. The human military force on Paradise had shrunk by almost 40%, due to people seeing no point to being part of a military organization that no longer had a military mission. Nearly 4 in 10 UNEF soldiers had already opted to put aside their uniforms and become civilians. Mostly farmers, although the humans had a growing economy, and more people left the UN Expeditionary Force every day. At current trends Perkins had seen in a classified report from UNEF HQ, it was estimated that within 2 years, only 10% of humans on Paradise would still be wearing a uniform. Elections were scheduled for the next year, after which the military would be subject to the authority of civilian leadership. Civilian humans on Paradise. She had to shake her head at that concept. The force was evaporating as their original mission faded away into history. Emily had briefly considered hanging up her own uniform, but at the moment she was having too much fun training with the Ruhar. Even if the majority of hamsters considered including her team in their training to be a joke, as long as her little team wore UNEF patches on their uniforms and participated in training, the Ruhar were reminded their continued possession of the planet they called Gitanu was thanks to the actions of humans, and that 40,000 Ruhar owed their lives to Perkins and her team blowing up an island to wipe out a group of Kristang commandos, while the hamsters, with all their superior genetics and technology, had no idea that crack group of commandos even existed. It was important for the Ruhar to be reminded that humans could be useful, had been useful. So Emily and her team endured the jokes, the insults, both subtle and openly stated, and showed the UNEF flag to represent all of humanity. She wrapped a hand on the doorframe and straightened her shoulders.
You wished to see me, ma'am?
General Lynn Besenson looked up from her tablet and silently waved Perkins into the office, swallowing the coffee she had just sipped.
Perkins, come in. Sit down.
Saluting had mostly been dispensed with inside the building, especially as Perkins and Besenson were probably the only two humans in the building that day. When Perkins and her team had accepted the opportunity to train with the Ruhar Army, Besenson had moved from southern Lemuria to be UNEF's liaison to Chief Administrator Lugelia, which is why Besenson had a small office in the main administration building, only one floor below Lugelia's own suite of offices.
Coffee.
Lynn raised her plastic mug with the UNEF logo and pointed to it.
Real coffee. Can you beat that?
It tastes real anyway. Better than a lot of the army coffee I've had on Earth. She beamed with joy and took another sip of the precious liquid. Supplies of coffee from Earth had long ago been exhausted, and Lynn found the lack of the bitter brew almost more difficult to accept than the loss of her favorite foods. For breakfast, she loved hard-boiled eggs with maple-flavored bacon. But while chickens on Paradise were producing a decent supply of eggs, there was no bacon anywhere. Some people were experimenting with making bagels, but without peanut butter, Lynn didn't see the point of eating a bagel.
Pour yourself a cup.
The general gestured to the pot simmering in a corner of the office. Perkins poured herself a cup, noting the pot was nearly empty, and knowing coffee was still in very short supply on Paradise. She sniffed, then took a tentative sip.
Not bad. Better than typical gas station coffee.
Besenson nodded with enthusiasm.
There's cream, real cream, from Lemuria in the fridge.
Perkins had liked cream in her coffee, but she had been out of the coffee-drinking habit, and knew cream also had to be in short supply, especially in the planet's capital city.
I'll drink it black. I want to savor it straight.
Well, take all you want. It's due to you and your team that we have coffee.
And chocolate!
Lynn clapped her hands with delight. Did you read last week's intel summary? We could have beef in 6 months. Beef!
I haven't had a steak and...
She looked at the ceiling.
Too long. If we do get beef, I'm going to have corned beef and cabbage, even if I have to prepare the beef myself.
Perkins had read the report about Ruhar scientists working to modify their own lab-grown meat for human consumption. There were cows on Paradise, but they were exclusively for milk production. Because the Ruhar considered killing animals for food to be barbaric, UNEF had a ban on eating cows or chickens or the few other types of animals that had made the long trip from Earth before the Kristang stopped shipping in supplies. Of course, there were occasional violations of the strict vegetarian policy, but penalties were severe, and the Ruhar were generally satisfied that the humans who did eat animals were an anomaly. Now there was potential for meat to be added to the human diet once again, even if the source of that meat had never walked around on two or four legs. Perkins had tasted experimental lab-grown chicken created by the Ruhar, and while it had a somewhat spongy mouthfeel, it tasted like genuine chicken. Supposedly considerable progress had been made to bring lab-grown chicken into production, and now the Ruhar scientists were trying to create lab-grown beef. Perkins knew that officially. The Ruhar were creating lab-grown meat and genetically engineering plants to grow coffee and cocoa beans and other Earth delicacies as a gesture of gratitude. Gratitude for lowly humans having destroyed a Kristang battle group and then saving the lives of 40,000 civilians. Perkins was sure gratitude played some part in motivating the Ruhar effort, but the hamster scientists she had spoken with were eager for the genetic engineering challenges of modifying native plants to produce foods for human consumption. The human presence on Paradise provided a convenient excuse for research efforts the Ruhar wanted to pursue anyway.
Beef would be great, Perkins agreed while savoring the coffee. I am getting tired of vegetable lasagna. How many Unars did this coffee cost you?
She asked, concerned she might be sipping a treat the general had spent a week's pay to get. After initially relying on a barter system, the human economy on Paradise now had a currency called the Unar, based on a bushel of corn. Barter was still used for many agricultural products, but increasingly, people were conducting transactions and thinking in Unars.
Nothing. Besenson shook her head. These beans aren't from the coffee bean fields in Lemuria,
This came from an experimental batch. The botanists wanted an opinion from human taste buds before they engineer a plant to crank out these beans.
Perkins took another sip and swirled the hot liquid around her tongue.
It's got a nutty flavor, but there's a very bitter taste. It's subtle.
Yeah, I told them that. They said the bitterness is likely from the layers of pulp between the bean and the outer coating. They're going to work on it.
They seemed very pleased, she noted with a smile, when I told them how they need to adjust the flavor. I really threw them a loop when I asked if they can make old-fashioned English tea like orange pekoe.
Can they? Perkins asked hopefully.
The hamster? Besenson glanced guiltily out her open office door. Ruhar, I asked, is taking that task as a personal challenge. It helps that his sister and her family were on one of those ships you prevented the Kristang from blowing up. So, thank you.
She raised her mug as a salute.
You are welcome. Perkins returned the salute.
You didn't call me here to talk about coffee, General.
No, I didn't. First, there's this.
Besenson opened a drawer and pulled out a small red box, tossing it to Perkins, who opened it and looked up in surprise.
That's right. The general grinned broadly, happy to be delivering good news for a change. You're a lieutenant colonel now, so you should be wearing the proper insignia. There will be a formal ceremony at UNFHQ in Lemuria later this week. I don't think you should have to wait.
Sorry your team didn't get a proper ceremony before, but you were busy.
I'm honored, ma'am. You deserve that promotion 10 times over. But we already promoted one person directly to colonel, and that didn't work out too well.
A frown flashed across her face as she recalled the unknown fate of Joseph Bishop.
We're going to meet the Burgermeister after lunch today. I want you wearing your new rank insignia then.
Emily Perkins stared at the silver oak leaves of her new insignia while she ran a thumb over one of the gold oak leaves on her uniform.
I'll put them on when we finish here, ma'am.
General Besenson saw the frown on the junior officer's face.
What's wrong?
It's just... Perkins looked at the UNF patch on her sleeve. It feels odd to be promoted in a force that gets more irrelevant every day. The intel summary said, what, 1,700 troops left the service just in the past week?
1,739, yes.
Lynn glanced at her tablet.
The previous week that number was over 2,000.
Ma'am, somehow it feels like we're losing.
I understand how it feels. But HQ tells us that people leaving the force is a good thing in the long run. The economists say military personnel don't generate as much economic activity because much of our time is devoted to what economists call non-productive tasks. She winked.
I find that ironic, Perkins said with a laugh.
That what you and I do is considered non-productive?
No, Perkins shook her head. That we now have economists at HQ.
Yes, Besenson agreed. I noticed very few of them have resigned their commissions.
Really, though, her expression turned serious. They're right about the benefits in the long run. Civilians are responsible for feeding themselves, or they will be within 2 years if the resettlement plan works. What is most important about the process HQ is calling demilitarization is how it affects the hamster's attitude toward our presence here. You and your team are showing the flag and reminding them how useful humans can be to the Ruhar military. But you also remind them that humans came to paradise as a military occupation force. The Burgermeister tells me that when we get to the point where 90% or more of the human population are civilians, the Ruhar view of us will change. The average hamster won't see humans as a defeated enemy force. They will see us as a primitive species that got suckered and used by the Kristang. They'll see us as a people caught up in a war we didn't start and don't want.
Ha! Perkins snorted.
The Ruhar brought the war to us. They saw us as primitive natives about to be invaded by the Kristang, and their response tells us how they would act if we were allies. They could have come to Earth, warned us about the lizards, and helped us prepare a defense. Instead, they knocked our infrastructure back into the pre-industrial age and bugged out without ever looking back to see what a mess they left behind.
The end result would have been the same, maybe worse, if they had tried to help us. We would not have believed them, and even if we knew the true nature of the Kristang right from the start, we would have sent the expeditionary force out to serve them because we wouldn't have had a choice. The Ruhar have been fighting this war for a very long time, since before humans had civilization. Most of them are sick of fighting. They hit us to get it over with as quickly and efficiently as possible. She shrugged. If they are so tired of fighting, why are they still doing it? They could drop back into a purely defensive posture, Perkins mused sourly. Colonel, General Bezinson referred to the other woman's new rank. You are an intel officer. If I suggested the hamsters cease all offensive operations, what would be your assessment of that idea? Perkins frowned. I tell you it wouldn't work, unless the Kristang stop being Kristang. The lizards are caught up in a nice little civil war now, Bezinson observed. Ruhar Intel says they expect the war to continue for another 3 to 4 years before winding down. Add on another 2 to 5 years for whoever comes out of the war on top to rebuild and consolidate their position. Then they'll be spoiling for a fight with the Ruhar and Torgala. Why? Perkins sighed. They've been doing the same thing for thousands of years. Will they never learn? Kristang warrior caste psychology and internal politics require the strongest clans to constantly push outward to acquire new territory. In part, that constant conflict gives their young, lower-ranking warriors something to expend their energy on, rather than causing trouble for clan leadership. Their society needs war, or the entire reason for the warrior caste would disappear. And then the Ruhar and Torgala will get stuck in the war whether they like it or not, Perkins noted, while wondering how true that really was. The Ruhar had originally taken the planet Gitanu away from the Kristang Black Trees clan, not because Paradise was strategically important to the Ruhar defense posture, but because the Ruhar wanted more territory for their growing population. Humans had been exiled to the jungles of northern Lemuria, then forced to move out because Ruhar real estate developers wanted to create communities there, and the hamsters knew their property values would be lowered if dangerous humans were in the area. The Ruhar were not innocents in the ongoing conflict, and they certainly were not good guy saviors of humanity. The actions of the hamsters at Earth proved the Ruhar only cared about their own strategic interests, and had given little thought about how lowly humans would be affected by being dragged into the endless war. Perkins did not fault the Ruhar for putting their own interests first, but the incident caused her to remind herself every time she had dealings with the technologically superior species who owned the planet, that the fate of humans meant little to the Ruhar and their federal government. Our civvies here will play the part of innocent farmers, while my team reminds the Ruhar that they owe us, Perkins guessed. Something like that, yes, Bezinson agreed. Your team also keeps us in the game. If the hamsters are our patrons here and they're going to keep fighting, we want the ability to defend ourselves, because we sure as hell can't count on the hamsters protecting us if they really get pushed by the Kristang or whoever. Even after Perkins and her team destroyed a Kristang battle group and secured control of the planet for the Ruhar, the distant federal government had still wanted to give the planet back to the Kristang and leave humans at the mercy of the lizards. Discovery of valuable elder artifacts had persuaded the Ruhar to retain control of the planet they called Gitanu, but Bezinson knew that situation could change in a heartbeat. If the Ruhar suffered a serious military setback in that part of the sector, they might be forced to pull their battle group away from Paradise. If that happened, Lin did not think the unlikely prospect of finding more elder goodies would make the Ruhar determined to keep the planet. Already, the failure of Ruhar scientists to find even a single additional elder artifact was causing rumblings in their military about the value of keeping a battle group stationed at such a backwater world. Chief Administrator Lugelia had told Lin that in a few years the growing population of Gitanu, plus the substantial investments the planet was attracting, would soon cross a threshold where it would be politically poisonous for the Ruhar federal government to abandon that world. But that threshold had not been reached yet, and the number of ships assigned to the Gitanu battle group had shrunk every time the task force rotated commanders. Enough depressing talk. Lin slapped the table emphatically and pulled 2 more boxes from the open drawer.
She lifted the lid of the first box, displaying a dozen chocolates. "Latest batch from Ruhar Labs. These in the center are chocolate-dipped caramels," she announced as she took one of the delicacies and popped it in her mouth. "Mmm." Perkins's eyelids fluttered in ecstasy as she savored a caramel. "It tastes just like real chocolate. I've been challenging them to make maple syrup, but the only sample we have left is half a bottle that got cooked pretty badly while it was in the jungle," she noted with disappointment. She had tasted that bottle, but it already had an off flavor, so she returned it to the owner and instructed the Ruhar not to use it as a flavor example. "Now, the fun part." She pulled the lid off the second box, exposing a stack of Velcro-backed patches. "This will be your new unit symbol. We're calling your team the Mavericks." Perkins picked up one of the patches, studying it. "Mavericks, huh? The idea came from one of the referees from that last war game. She said your team was the element the Yellow Commander failed to account for. Also," Besenson cocked her head, "you kind of have a reputation for going off and doing whatever you feel like, and maybe telling HQ about it later. You could at least send us a postcard, Perkins." "Uh-huh." Perkins's cheeks reddened slightly, knowing she could not argue with the general's comment. "I guess Mavericks is appropriate. Do the hamsters know what the word means?" "Probably not." Besenson made a mental note to check on that. "You like it?" "My team will love it," Perkins replied happily. Her team were still wearing the symbols of their old units that were now increasingly irrelevant. It was time for Coulter and Chaika, for example, to replace their 10th Infantry insignia, as they had not served in what was left of the 10th on Paradise for a long time. "So the Ruhar don't have any hard feelings about the results of that war game?" "Quite the opposite. The Yellow Team Commander wrote a glowing evaluation of your team and recommended you be approved for an off-world training assignment." "Off-world?" Perkins gasped. Lynn Besenson's grin was almost wider than the one lighting up Perkins's face. "Specifically, a fleet assignment. They have a dedicated training ship, an old cruiser. If you're interested..." "Interested? Hell yes, we're interested." Perkins knew she didn't need to ask her team. They were all eager for an opportunity to get aboard a Ruhar warship. "You'd be away for 2 or 3 months. That's the length of a typical training cruise. Sign us up." She would need to concern herself later with the logistic details of humans being aboard a Ruhar ship. "It's going to be a lot of work just to qualify for spaceborne duty," the general warned the overeager new lieutenant colonel. "Spaceborne?" "Spaceborne Army," Besenson explained. "That's the closest translation of the Ruhar term. The Ruhar don't have a distinction between soldiers based on land or ships like we do with the Army and Marine Corps, because all their troops rotate between dirtside and shipboard. The training cruiser arrives here in 4 months thereabouts, and you have a lot of work to do before you can be space duty certified. That includes working in spacesuits in a zero-G environment. Your pilots need to transition to flying a dropship. They will have the most challenging training. All of you will need training to help with damage control aboard the ship." "Of course." "Just the 6 of us?" Perkins asked. Many people wanted to join her unit, but to date, UNEF had not allowed her to add personnel to her accidental team. UNEF HQ did not want to dilute the positive publicity of her team by adding people who had not already destroyed a battle group and saved thousands of Ruhar lives. 7, Besenson corrected. "Cadet Derndorf will be coming with you." "Oh?" Perkins expressed surprise. After the war game, Nert had returned to his studies at the military academy. He sent them messages regularly, but he was too busy for anyone to visit. "Going aboard the ship for a training cruise is a regular part of the academy's program. Usually a training cruise is reserved for 3rd and 4th year students. But they will make an exception for Nert, if you want him with you." "General," Perkins responded carefully. "We all love his fuzzy face, and having him with us would smooth things for us aboard the ship, but..." "But?" Besenson asked with a raised eyebrow. "Look, when the burger..."
When his aunt Baterna requested her nephew to join my team, I was not happy about the prospect of babysitting a teenager. Since then, he has proven to be very useful to us. My whole team loves having him around, and he's got a great future ahead of him.
You haven't got to the but yet, Colonel.
But, Perkins paused.
I am concerned his service with us is not good for him. We take up a lot of his time. If he misses assignments while serving as my liaison officer, he has to make it up when he returns to the academy. He tells us he is famous now at school, and that puts a lot of pressure on him. Plus, her expression turned angry. Some of the cadets are mean to him because he associates with humans.
Perkins, I appreciate your concern. I've met Nerd, and I like the little guy, too.
He's not so little anymore, Perkins interjected.
And he's a teenager. If his classmates didn't tease him about spending time with us, they'd pick on him about something else.
True enough, Perkins admitted. She held up one of the Maverick's patches.
Okay if I send one of these to Nert? He'd be tickled.
Well, his skin is already pink under the fur, she laughed, and Besenson laughed with her.
Perkins, it will be your call whether Nert will be with you or not. The Academy hasn't made the offer to him, so if you decide against the idea, he won't know the decision was yours.
I know, Nert. If he found out the Mavericks are going on a training cruise without him, he would be heartbroken.
All right. I need to think about how to make this work. But it sure would make life easier for us if he's with us.
Well, decision made, then, the General concluded.
Perkins, I like that you are considering the impact on your liaison officer, but you need to prioritize the benefits to humanity, and UNEF in particular. Your team will be the first to get an opportunity to go off-world. Everyone's eyes will be on you. Any screw-ups will reflect badly on all humans. If Cadet Durndorf can make your job a bit easier, you need to take that opportunity.
Do I want to go off-world?
Jesse's eyes bulged as the idea of being an astronaut, a space soldier, sank in.
Yeah, I don't know about y'all, he pointed to his companions, but I plan to carpe that diem until it begs for its mama.
Perkins had to laugh with the rest of them.
Coulter, I appreciate your enthusiasm. Let's see if you're as happy about the idea when you're stuck in a hamster spacesuit and they're spinning you around 100 RPMs in 0G.
Don't you worry none about me, man. And to stay fair, I'm the guy who eats corn dogs on a roller coaster while everyone else is losing their lunch.
He pointed a thumb toward Chaika.
Ski's the guy you have to worry about. Me? When did you ever see me on a roller coaster?
Don't need to. Jesse shook his head with exaggerated sadness.
Remember when we was in that Black Hawk over Dogon Dava in Nigeria? You got sick, too. That helo almost chucked upside down in that storm, Dave explained. If we hadn't been strapped in, all of us would have fallen out the door.
All I can say is, your breakfast ended up in my boots, Jesse grinned.
Don't worry, Colonel, he addressed their leader. I'll keep an eye on Ski if his widow baby tummy gives him any trouble.
People, in all seriousness, this assignment is going to be tough. No humans have been through this training, so we don't know whether we can even get through the program. The next 4 months could be rough.
Shauna crossed her arms defiantly. No hamster was going to keep her from serving aboard a starship.
No humans ever wiped out a lizard battle group, or nuked an island, Irene nudged her friend playfully.
Yeah, that too, Shauna admitted with a sheepish grin.
Spaceborne army, huh? I like the sound of that.
She unconsciously touched the infantry patch on her uniform, wondering what a spaceborne army insignia looked like. She could send the question to Nert. He would surely know.
When do we get started?
8 days, Perkins replied happily, seeing the enthusiasm of her team.
Until then, you're all on leave, so enjoy yourselves and keep in touch.
Hey, Ski!
Dave turned to see Pete Sanchez elbowing through the crowd toward him. The bar was packed even at midday. The popularity of the establishment was more a function of there still being few places in Lemuria that had a supply of alcohol rather than the quality of the beverages served in the bar.
Pete! Damn good to see you,
Dave called out, pointing to a narrow space next to him at the bar. It was good to see a familiar face, as Dave had found the bar distressingly full of strangers, including a lot of the former Indian military.
Pete Sanchez had served in Sergeant Joe Bishop's embedded observation team at the village of Tescor, way back when UNEF first landed on Paradise. Dave had gotten into contact with Pete after the Ruhar finished interrogating everyone who served closely with Bishop. Other than both serving with Bishop, the two originally had little in common, but soon developed a friendship during a rather raucous fishing trip up in the mountains. That fishing trip also introduced Dave to Pete's entrepreneurial side, with that soldier bringing along portable chiller units to store the fish they caught. While Dave expected the fishing action would all be catch and release because neither humans nor Ruhar could eat the native life on Paradise, Pete had quickly explained why he had chosen that particular lake for the fishing trip. Years before, that lake had been part of a planned resort, so the lake was stocked with fish from the Ruhar homeworld. While plans for the resort had failed, the fish had thrived, and Pete planned to catch, clean, and ship out as many fish as they could catch. Pete had an arrangement with a UNEF pilot who diverted to the lake each morning and took the previous day's catch to fly up to a Ruhar settlement in northern Lemuria. The Ruhar had a general distaste for eating animals, but some made an exception for tasty fish, and they paid well. Pete split the money with Dave, Jesse, and three others, putting a nice chunk of money in the wallet stored on Dave's Z-phone.
"You still got the fishing thing going?"
"No," Pete shook his head. "Too many people went up there. The Ruhar put a stop to it because we were wiping out the fish population."
"Raj,"
he caught the bartender's eye.
"Two beers for me and my friend here."
"Thanks, man.
Hey, sorry about the fish."
"Ah," Pete waved a hand dismissively.
"I've got another thing going."
He took two bottles from the bartender and handed one to Dave.
"You like it?"
The bottle was not glass, but it was cold, and one sip told Dave it was real beer, not the rot-gut alcohol distilled out of whatever agricultural leftovers could be found. He turned the bottle around to see a smiling, straw hat-wearing hamster on the label. "Lester Cornhut's Paradise Pale Ale," he read the label.
"Hey, I know that name from somewhere."
Pete grinned and took a big swig of beer.
"Uh-huh. He is the mayor of Tescor, the village our embedded observation team was stationed when we went feet dry down here with Bishop."
"Damn, Lester Cornhut is his real name?
I thought you were joking," Dave laughed.
"That hamster is brewing beer now?"
"Yep, for me."
Pete puffed his chest with pride.
"We kept in touch after UNEF pulled us out. He invested in expanding capacity of his processing plant. But with farms popping up all over the planet, prices crashed, and he was looking for an opportunity. I had been brewing my own beer, so we got together. Now part of the land around Tescor has been planted with hops and barley, and we're adding wheat for our summer ale."
"Shit, man, when do you have the time for all this?"
"I quit the force a month ago."
That surprised Dave.
"Wow."
He lowered his voice.
"Are you sure about that?"
"Best decision I made since we landed here," Pete declared.
"Dave, I gotta ask you. Are you sure about staying in the army? I know you had fun in that war game, but that's over, so now what are you gonna do now? If the X-Force had a real mission, I might still be wearing the uniform, but I don't see the point to playing soldier."
He shook his head sadly and drained the last of the beer.
"You know, when the hamsters won't let us fight."
"We've gotten into fights," Dave replied coolly, feeling offended.
"Yeah, and you guys seriously kicked ass."
Pete's admiration was clear.
"But Ski, come on. You got into those fights on your own initiative, not because the hamsters trusted you in combat."
He waved a hand for another couple of beers.
"You can't count on stumbling into action, not when the hamsters treat us like pets."
"What's next for you?"
"I don't know," Dave answered truthfully.
Pete was correct that with the war game over, Perkins planned to argue for her team to have a continued role serving alongside Ruhar military units, but even she had not been optimistic. The initial enthusiasm of the Ruhar army to relearn infantry tactics with human advisors providing guidance had faded. Upper echelons of the Ruhar military were insulted by the idea they could learn anything from primitive humans and considered the possibility of another straight-up infantry battle to be remote. Most of the human advisors had been relegated to the role of observers, and many quit after being insulted too many times by their reluctant Ruhar hosts.
"The colonel got us an assignment off-world for a couple months. After that, I don't know," he admitted.
"The colonel,"
Yeah. Pete nodded slowly. Emily Perkins, right? Dave, look around. What do you see here that you don't usually see much of? Dave craned his neck to scan the crowd, then turned back to the bar. We don't get drunk.